So I don't need to tell you that the United States of America is a country of many immigrants. In fact, this is how it came to be for the most part. And it's so it happens to be a country of very many languages. If you look at the Nobel laureates for the year 2015, there's a total of 11 winners. The United States makes a large proportion of the winners, and of those, only one is actually born in the United States. So it's a country that profits on the fact that this is how it's made. It's made out of many people and many faces and many languages. What you're hearing is my Russian accent, and such is life. However, my friends, the issue is the paradox. On the one hand, wouldn't it have been lovely if you could speak multiple languages? Babies seem to be like little sponges. They just sponge it all up. I dare any of you, you know, to come back to me in a year and speak fluent Russian. But we also worry as parents, will my child be delayed if they're learning multiple languages from early life? Will my child be confused? Are they going to talk the same as the neighbor's kid who doesn't speak multiple languages? I've been caught on a playground right outside of Harvard and MIT with parents being very concerned about these things, with pediatricians telling them to wait. So this is a real concern for parents, for teachers, for educators, for clinicians. There's one of these pervasive worries. Well, it's wonderful eventually, but what's happening on the ground when you're a parent of a small child? We'll discuss this issue by talking about language acquisition, and then the same concerns comes right back when you go to school. Is it going to be okay if they learn two alphabets at the same time, or is it just going to confuse the bejesus out of them? Should you learn to read in one language first, and that will help you learn to read in another language, whereas when you learn to read in the two languages at the same time, that's just going to confuse you, right? That's the question. So let's take a look. In bilingual language acquisition, so timing, everything is time, and timing is of essence. Do bilingual children acquire linguistic milestones at the same time as the monolingual kids? Are the kids confused? Are they learning one language that's just a mixture of the two, or are they really learning the two languages? If you've ever interacted with a bilingual baby, you'd discover they're using both languages at the same time. Is there a mess in their heads? Are they confused? And that leads to assumptions about the brain. Is the human brain built to learn one language? And early exposure to two is potentially an insult on your mental processes that will consequently delay and confuse these processes, therefore requiring you to take more time to let things settle in. And of course, this leads to implications for education. Our neighbors just north in Canada have continual debates. Well, Canada's a bilingual country. We want children to learn French and English. We know that teaching them French and English early is very good for ultimate outcomes. But what's going to happen if we teach them to read them French and English on day one? That's just going to confuse them, right? So these are real questions, practical questions asked every day across countries, across families, across classrooms. So let's start at the beginning. Let's start with the timing. In language acquisition, we talk about universal milestones. We call them universal because babies downtown Manhattan, the Amazon jungle, go through these milestones at the same time. It doesn't matter. The variation in caregiving and in languages makes no impact. At about 6 to 5 months, babies will begin to babble, ba 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 da 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 da. At about 12 months, they'll produce their first word, the excitement every parent waits for. At about 18 months, they'll produce their first two word sentences. And at 24 months, they will have about a 50-word repertoire, nothing to be reckoned with. So what happens if you're learning two? Remember, there's also variation. So if you have had kids, you would know some babies start to talk at 8 months and others, you know, sit and wait till 15 months before that precious first word comes up. So there's healthy variation. And we're wondering if the bilingual kids' first milestones are coming within that normative variation. So this is the first word milestone. You can see how various studies will find varying points at which kids begin to talk, monolingual kids begin to talk. So this is a study that we did at the turn of this century, and it was in Montreal, and the kids were speaking French and English, and the kids were also, they were hearing children born to deaf adults, which means these children of deaf adults, CODAs, if you haven't heard this acronym, that means they're bilingual, bimodal, they're learning a spoken language, they're learning a sign language. So not to overload you, but at the background runs a question whether speech is privileged over a sign language. That was the question my PhD advisor was asking. So, but for the purposes of today's talk is the comparison between the bilingual speakers and the monolingual speakers. So in the tried and true tradition of the single subject designs, we had about 25 babies, and we watched them every week, and we called the parents every week, and we came with a camera, and we transcribed what they did and how they said in which language. So this is what we have. So this is a speech-speech bilingual learning English and French, as is typical of Montreal families. The first word in English is coming in about a year and 2 months. The first word in French is coming about 1 year. And the monolingual range is exactly about 9 to 14 months. Two-word combinations, these are our first sentences. We call them the telegraphic speech, where they would put something like two nouns together. My kid used to say yogurt banana. He wanted the banana yogurt, so it's yogurt banana. No function words, but these are basic sentences, and they're coming in at 1 year and 8 months for English and 1 year and 5 months for French. And this is very well within the monolingual range. The 50-word milestone, now to count the 50-word milestone in the bilinguals, you sum up the two vocabularies, right? So you take the French and the English and you add them up and you get your 50-word milestone at 109. Oh, sorry, no, this is for each language. So this is at 109 and at 105, so we're good to go. And then the same thing for a bilingual learning a spoken language, French, and a sign language. In the case of the Montreal population, this would be Langue des Signes Quebecois, the Quebec Sign Language. And again, so the first word is well within the monolingual milestone. The two-word combination is well within the monolingual milestone. And the 50 words is also well within the monolingual milestone. So two questions are being asked. Is the timing of the bilingual child different from that of a monolingual child? And the answer is no. The next question that is being asked, what about the two languages? Are different languages coming in at different times? And the answer is again, no. The two languages are emerging at the same time within each other, right? They're not on the same day, but they're well within the range for the monolingual milestones and within very close proximity of each other. These are babies systematically exposed to two languages at the same time, right? And we're talking not about the amount, we're talking about the milestones, those universal milestones of language acquisition that are similar to sign spoken languages and varying variations in rearing environments. So, bilinguals versus monolinguals. If I called you, I don't know, 3 in the morning later today, and I said, are bilingual kids delayed? And your answer should be absolutely not. The bilingual kids are learning their languages at the same time. And they're learning the two, the right? So the milestones in each of their languages are achieved at the same time. So in the next question that we would ask is, well, what's about all that endless literature that is coming out continuously that goes on to show, well, they are delayed. Sorry, I can't walk away. So this is a recent paper by a very good colleague of mine who I like as a researcher and a person. But this exemplifies, right, this is about 10 years after we've published our work and much of the field had agreed that bilinguals are not delayed. It doesn't stop the field from producing findings like these. So we're going to look at the monolinguals in English. And here's the bilinguals in English. And here's the bilinguals in Spanish. These are Spanish and English bilinguals in Florida. And what you're discovering when you do this is that, well, kind of close, but no, right? Below. If you do this, Well, it all looks the same. So these are the two word combinations. This is our first index of syntactic grammar, right? This is the first step into grammar, the two word combinations. So the way we count these up is what you do is you're going to ask the child to play with you for about half hour, and then you transcribe what they said, and then you look at the transcript, and there's going to be a lot of single word utterances, red, ball, but then you count up all the two ones. And so what you would see, if you split the transcript, the English and the Spanish separately, you're going to get, and you average then across children, you get these graphs. But if you do not split the bilingual languages at all, you just treat them as one continuum and you count them up, then the proportion of two-word combinations to single-word combination now does not vary. So which way is it really? Is it one or is it two, or are they delayed or not? So as Thad had mentioned, I had a lovely year last year in Texas with the University of Texas at Austin. And after several margaritas, I had asked my colleague who was hosting me, what's happening? 10 years ago, we had published this data. The book closed shut. We said, they're not delayed. These kids are not delayed. If they're exposed, of course, if you speak Spanish till you go to kindergarten and then you get English at kindergarten, there's going to be a catch-up period. But if the kid's exposed to two languages from birth, which happens to so many kids, they're not delayed. Where's all this coming from? And so my colleague Elizabeth Penny said, well, let's go to the lab tomorrow morning and take a look at this. And she made fabulous margaritas, too. So we went back to the lab the next day, and the Texas Austin area is 50% Latino. It's really lovely, 50% Latino. So a lot of the kids speak Spanish, and they're on varying scale of dominance from Spanish dominant to English dominant. These are working class families, by and large, making a home in Austin, Texas. And the laboratory I was visiting has been doing this research for about 20 years. And so when she said, let's go to the lab and look at the data, that means thousands of child data points. So what are the data points you'd want to look at? Well, let's see. If you think about the English monolinguals, all you're going to be hearing through your early life is English, right? 100% English info. Daycare, school, mom, dad, nanny, grandparents. If you're a bilingual kid and you're a balanced bilingual kid, it's split. It's 50-50, right? Mom speaks English, dad speaks Spanish, nanny speaks Spanish, grandma speaks Spanish, daycare speaks English. So now your input is halved. So we looked through the data and we said, okay, well, let's look at the worst case scenario where the kid's input is really in half. So they're compared to a monolingual child, they're really getting half their input in one of the languages and half the input in the other language, right? So they're really 50% of what a monolingual kid potentially is getting. So these were balanced, and this is what we call balanced input bilingual. So these are kids ages 4 to 6, and they had 40 to 60% in each of input in each of their languages. Ignore the red color for the moment, I'll explain that. And so imagine what would happen if you were to test these children only in English. I have to walk for a second, right? This slide. So you're only looking at English. This is a terrifying sight, my friend. Right here cuts the line for language impairments, right? So all of these kids would wind up in your language impaired group. Very scary. I mean, these kids are going to be fine. So what about 80? Right, these are standard scores for those of you who know. So these are standard scores. Most of the population is supposed to be at 100. At about 85, we'll get worried when we think the kid's dyslexic, has a language impairment, something's going on. Well, let's do the other thing and test them in Spanish. Well, that's not any better. Again, you take half the kids and you, well, they need to see a speech pathologist. There's a language impairment going on. Only half of these are doing well. In reality, these are the kids who really are seeing a speech pathologist. So the red dots are the kids diagnosed with an SLI. They were pre-diagnosed by the speech pathologist. We tested along with the normative population to see how do they compare to the normative population. So here's the deal. Most bilingual children will have, even with a split 50-50 input, you think they're balanced, they'll still have a dominant language. And that dominant language will fall into the normative range. So for the other language that is not necessarily the dominant language, you will find You know, here's the child, 40% on this language, but here he is, 110 on the other language. And we can find some kids over here. Again, 40% on one, but well within the normative range on the other. And look how many kids right here in this quadrant who are at 100 and above for both of their languages. Isn't this beautiful? So these are the kids we're talking about. The issues that we have, for those of you who've ever seen language assessment, language assessment measures, and a lot of them are culture specific. So there'll be questions about the Boy Scouts and the camping and things that a bilingual child may not have actually experienced or be familiar with. So bilingual kids often will perform below the normative letter range, but so will the low SAS kids and such. And the questions have consistently been, how culturally appropriate are some of these measures, and are they fully measuring the linguistic competence the children truly have? And we'll come back to this discussion. All right, so bilinguals versus monolinguals. Again, if I called you at 3 in the morning in a week and said, are they delayed? You will say no. Bilinguals reach language milestones at the same time as monolinguals. And in their two languages, bilinguals can reach language milestones in each of the language at the same time. Dominant language has got to be on time. And you're actually at risk because both of your languages are delayed. If you're finding a kid who is delayed in both the languages, you should send them to a speech pathologist. Do not discard it on the account of, oh, well, you know, this is not Mexico, and therefore they don't speak Spanish well, and they're second language learners, and therefore they don't speak English well. Some of you here are familiar with El Nuestra Lingua, the Spanish school in town, and we have literally had a couple of kids come through where we told the parents, we said, look, your kid's not doing well in either of these languages. You got to go see some help. And they're like, well, that's not a problem. The teachers told us they're catching up on English. I was like, well, never mind the English. You have to look at the Spanish, my friends, because that's not their, well, they're not in Mexico. Here's the scores in both of your languages. Go see your school speech pathologist. So it's real. The delays can be real, but at the same time, a lot of the kids will be right on track for both of their languages. And again, the data I just showed you, working class families in Texas, Austin, kids reaching normative development in both of their languages. So as we talked earlier, some of these tests literally lack the sensitivity to fully assess the linguistic competence of a child for various reasons. Vocabulary tests are easy to acknowledge. Syntax tests are not easy to acknowledge. Syntax tests don't show much variability past the age of 7, because if you don't have syntax past the age of 7, then excuse me, what's wrong with you, right? These are the things that, meaning, can you arrange words in your sentence? If you can't arrange a word in your sentence past the age of seven, there's really not much developmental trajectory. There is, however, a developmental trajectory. It's just more subtle and harder to measure. And we also find it in the brain. So let's talk about the brain. Unlike the lungs that you know are for breathing and the heart that you know is for pumping blood and your stomach is for digesting something good, the brain, especially the cortex, when we're born, is not very well specialized for the functions that we have. So in an adult, the occipital lobe would process the vision, and the temporal cortices will process sound and language. It's very plastic, and these things will reorganize. So if the child is born blind, then hearing will go to the occipital cortex. If the child is born deaf, a lot of the visual processes and somatosensory will go to the temporal parts of the lobe. So experience plays a great role in the way the brain becomes specialized in the functions that we do, from language to hearing, and other things. So in case you hadn't known, language is on the left, by and large. It's on the left. The Broca's area is, since Paul Broca's discovery, we know, is the part of the brain that typically processes the language grammar. The tricky part is that this lateralization increases over time. So we know that when the babies are born, they will start off by showing a left lateralized response to language. However, the degree of this lateralization will increase over time. So this is a graph by colleagues of ours in Cincinnati. So what they did is they got a bunch of kids and they asked them to put them into an fMRI scanner, one of these loud machines that measures brain, and asked them to do a language test. And what they discovered is this: as children get older from age 6 to 18, the response becomes more specific to the left. So basically, you measure how much brain activity there is on the right and how much there is on the left, and you subtract one from the other. And so the values here go up, right? So left minus right, it's become increasingly positive, if that makes sense. The questions that we ask, does experience play a role, or is this just maturation? We know that the white matter, the corticate fasciculus that connects the parts of the brain that support language gets thicker over time, the connections get thicker over time, the cortex is developing. So how much of that is just biology, and how much of that is experience? So there's really little to go by in terms of child development on these and language. So this is a study by colleagues of ours who looked at five-year-old children, and children came from various socioeconomic backgrounds. They're different household incomes, essentially. And they were looking at the Broca's area. Let me get all of that up. So what they discovered is the kids... These were five-year-old kids, and they had to do a rhyme judgment task. Cat had rhymes. And what they had discovered is the high was the SAS of the family. The high was the left lateralization for the child's Broca's activity, essentially. Even though there were no differences in the kids' proficiency on the language measures that they administered, what they did see is that neurologically there's greater index of lateralization. So their interpretation for their findings was that enriched environment that often surrounds children from higher-income families and households likely plays a role in these kinds of neurological changes. Well, if that plays a role, well, how about bilingualism, which we know is an enriched linguistic experience? So Dr. Polk was mentioning a minute earlier, at the University of Michigan, I direct an optical neuroimaging laboratory. We use, literally, it looks like this. There's some cords connected to a computer. We put a cap on with the cords, and we shine light. This is what we do. So all of you can see light, red light coming through my finger. So this is near infrared light. It will go through the bone, literally, and will go into the cortical tissue, and it'll shine. It literally will shine light on your brain. And we put a detector next to it, and what we do is we measure the light that comes back. So if I do this, light has optical properties. If I do the blood, sorry, has optical properties. If I do this, my hands will get redder. So there's literally a change. And darker matter will absorb more light. So as the brain, part of the brain gets more active, it'll absorb more light. And so the amount of light I'll get back will change. So that's called a correlate of neuronal activity, and that's what we measure. So as I was just saying, so we place a detector which detects the amount of light being distributed, and the emitter right here, which emits light in a sort of, just the same way a light is emitted here, sort of shines like this. And in between them, what we call is a banana pattern. And here we measure signals. So these are some happy, the kids really don't mind. It's a cap. We tell them all manner of fun stories about this. And we measure their brain activity. All right. So does bilingualism delay children's cortical specialization for language? Essentially, does it take a bilingual long? Just we just asked a moment ago, does it take kids longer to develop the parts of the brain that are going to be specialized for the language processing compared to the monolingual kids? So we brought in a group of Spanish-English bilinguals living here in the Ann Arbor area. They're all the early bilinguals that we talked about earlier at the beginning of the talk. And we had language, IQ, SES matched monolingual children. We asked them to do grammaticality judgment tasks. So the kids heard a sentence, yesterday I go home, and they had to decide whether the sentence was good or bad, simple. And this is what we find. So remember we talked about whether the brain of a bilingual is delayed in developing that left lateralization for language, especially in the Broca's area. So here's what we find. First, we do a subtraction between monolinguals and bilinguals. This is the left hemisphere, and this is the right hemisphere. This is where the Broca's area is located, and this is where its homologue is in the right hemisphere. So we find it's actually the monolinguals who have more activation in the right, on the right side. So it's more on the right. And then this is outside the Broca's area. This is the middle frontal gyrus. It supports verbal working, your ability to remember sentences. Again, this is outside the classical Broca's area. And then we'll look at the bilinguals minus the monolinguals. And it's exactly the opposite. So actually, it's the bilingual kids who are showing more specialized activation in the left hemisphere. There's more adult-like pattern of brain activity in these kids' Broca's area. So earlier, we discussed whether we know all kids will eventually grow to have their language on the left and predominantly on the left. And so, you know, wear your helmets if brick falls on your left side. You're kind of going to lose your language. We tell the kids to wear helmets. So, the bicycle helmets and all. But this is kind of important. But it looks like our bilinguals are on that right trajectory and potentially even ahead of the monolingual kids. So bilinguals have a potentially more advanced brain organization for language because if you think about this, bilingualism is an enriching experience. You do speak two languages, two syntactic forms, two sets of lexical forms. So coming back to the idea of the timing of bilingual acquisition, we have on-time acquisition, especially for the stronger of the two languages. And potentially on-time or potentially even advanced brain development for language in the bilingual kids. And so when this translates into practice, if you think bilingual education is being, and then you can conceptualize it as an enriched language environment. You're presented with two words for the same object. It takes kids a very long time to explain why cat is cat. Well, cat's cat because it's catty, right? It takes them quite a while to understand how arbitrary the word is to the object. Bilingual kids get it sooner because guess what? They do have two words for the same object, so they get this arbitrary relationship a lot faster. So these are the kinds of things you can think about this sort of this metalinguistic practices, otherwise you don't get till you get to school, that they're exposed to very early in life. And so you can see this as an enriched environment. And yes, balanced bilingual input is okay, as I've shown you sort of worst case scenario kids where the input is really split between the two languages. They are quite on time in terms of their language acquisition. So let's talk about the confusion for a moment, a little bit. Confusion. There's two ways in science to become really famous. One of them is to make fundamental discoveries, and then everybody cites you. And then, pardon me, to say something so dumb and ridiculous that everybody has to prove you wrong and then cite you again in every paper for the next 20 years over. So I will not mention the name of this person, but what she published in the mid-90s was that bilingual kids are confused between their two languages and not differentiating them before the age of three. And indeed, if I just showed you a transcript of writing down what a bilingual baby says, it's a holy mess. It's one, right? Because it's first you have to think they're speaking one word at a time. And so there's a lot of these one words in different languages. And then there's this two-word combos in different languages. And so, yeah, you'd think they're pretty confused. And so the idea is that you have sort of one box, right? The two languages kind of getting dropped into this one box and it's not differentiated. Well, is it? Here's how you find out. You set up a room, you invite a mother with a baby, you invite your best friend who speaks the other language of the child, and you invite the mother to come in, and you let the mother to play with the baby, and then you ask the mother to sit down on the couch, and you play with the baby in one of the baby's languages, and then you leave the room, and your best friend or a colleague, your classmate, or your research assistant comes in and plays with the baby in the other language, right? And so we've got the mother, and then we call it the experimental language one and experimental language, rather A and B, right, because these are both first languages for a child. And you watch what happens. Okay, this is what happens. This is a French-English-speaking baby. This is the baby's one year. This is one word stage. This is one word at a time. Ball, red, picture, right? These are really simple first words. And so this is what the baby will do. The baby is speaking to the French-speaking mother, and there's both languages, just like I told you, both languages are there. But most of them are in French, and some of them are in English. And then you ask the mother to sit down, and an English-speaking researcher comes in and plays with the baby. Look at the shift. Look at that shift. And so the baby probably knows, the mom kind of knows English, but who knows about that other person? Maybe they don't. So in fact, these ratios will correspond to the amount of mixing the parents will do in sort of these healthy ways. But they're not confused, my friends. This is a one-year-old baby. They're producing one word at a time, and they're not confused. So this is another example. This is the signing and speaking children that we talked about earlier. So this is a deaf mother. It's not very productive to speak French to a deaf mother. It just doesn't help much. So I guess the baby figured that out. And so you see a lot of sign and not a lot of French. And then the mother sits down and a French-speaking experimenter comes in. Look at the switch happening again. Remember, so the really nice test case about the bimodal babies, try speaking French and English at the same time. You've got one mouth. Good luck. But in sign and speech, you can, right? I can do thank you. So you can actually produce both languages simultaneously. So those kids have got to be really confused. You can both use both languages at the same time. And that's really not what's happening. The baby is still doing the switch. Because the baby could have continued to sign. The experimenter wouldn't have known any better. We all gesture to some extent. But no, that's not what's happening. And no, my friends, the bilingual babies are not confused. So if I had called you again at 3 in the morning and asked you if the bilingual babies were delayed, you would say no. And if I asked you if they were confused, the answer is no. There's no point at which a bilingual baby is delayed. There's now evidence also on the perceptual continuum showing that these kids will use cues to identify words belonging to different languages and will learn in a language-appropriate manner. The reason we think there's no point of confusion is you're hearing my Russian accent. And what's coming with the Russian accent, Russian vowels and consonants are very similar to English. You're not hearing a difference in vowels and consonants. You're hearing the differences in ups and the downs. It's called the prosodic contour, the melody of the language. If I were to stand outside the door, you'd be able to say if I switch to English or to Russian, just depending on these prosodic contours. So when the bilingual infants, before they even begin to talk, hear language, it comes packaged in these contours. So you know, don't need to be confused at any point in time because they're packaged in these contours. And so you insert sounds and then words and then grammar in a language-appropriate manner because it is supported by this sort of larger envelope. So those are the kinds of theoretical perspectives that we have and the way we think about the way bilingual kids, as soon as they start talking, they're already on track and producing one language to the specific person. So an interesting line of research that had taken off from the idea of the bilingual language mixing and bilingual kids not being confused about their languages is that what if this actually improves kids' attention? So don't drive and be on the phone at the same time, but it's sort of like this, right? You got two languages at the same time and you're switching between the two of them. And so the hypothesis that people had asked, does this improve kids' attentional capabilities? Does this and somehow make bilinguals better at tasks of attention? And so there's some promising evidence. And as always in science, there's also evidence finding none of that. So there's studies that have found that bilingual kids do better on attention tasks, and there's studies who didn't. So one of the ways that we talked about earlier is, we can look under the hood and see what the brain does. And this is what we did. This is what a graduate student in my laboratory just defended her entire dissertation on. She was really keenly interested in this question. So the conflicting evidence in terms of getting or not getting bilingual influence could be, well, bilinguals doesn't really have an impact. Everything on planet Earth impacts children's development. So Thad might be taking people, you know, swimming and dancing, and you might be taking kids, roller coasting. Everybody's doing something, you know, brain's not on strike. So you have these different experiences. And so bilingualism is just one of these experiences that helps kids' cognitive development come along. In which case you can ask, well, in bilinguals, it's the language and it's the left hemisphere. Would maybe the left hemisphere is the one that's coming along here? And then again, behavioral tasks tend to lack sensitivity, which is the problem we technically have. So let's ask the brain. Do the children, the bilingual and monolingual children, vary in how they process attentional tasks? So this is the one of the very standard measures in the field of measuring attention called the flanker task. Sometimes the screen looks like this, and you see a fish, and all you have to say is whether the fish is pointing right or left. Is it going right or left?
Right.
Very good. This gets harder, but still pretty easy. So there's multiple fish now, all facing the same direction. You're still only to be concerned about this fish. Which way is it going? So now this is the incongruous trials, where you're still to pay attention only to the middle fish and ignore what we call the flanks, but the flanks are distracting. So the fish is going, the fish is still going left. So that's the task, and so you have to pay attention. And that's what the kids did while we measured their brain activity. And we don't find any behavioral differences in how they perform. So remember we talked about the bin. Some studies find effects and some studies don't. We don't. Let's look at the brain. So here's what happens. We'll look at the bilinguals versus, we look at the monolinguals versus bilinguals again. What we find is that the monolinguals show much greater right hemisphere activation during this task. This is normal. It's a visual, language is on the left. Visual spatial processing tends to go to the right. Kids kind of start off bilateral at some point and then it veers off. Language goes one way. Visual spatial processing tends to prefer the right hemisphere. And as kids get older, faster, better, in typical development, you would see the increase of right hemisphere engagement in these types of tasks. And that's what our monolingual kids are doing, especially when subtracted, when the bilinguals are subtracted out. This is what happens in bilinguals. It's the exact opposite. They're actually showing greater left hemisphere activation. This is the verbal hemisphere that is competing with some of the functions of the brain and takes over some of the processes, or at least increases engagement in some of these processes. In case of the bilinguals, we see greater left hemisphere participation. Brain's a muscle, just like any other muscle. If you're going to learn wrestling, well, you're going to bulk up here. If you're going to learn run this long distance running, you're going to need strong legs. In the case of a bilingual, the left hemisphere is put to its limit. You have to learn two phonological systems, two grammars, two different vocabularies, and possibly even to read in the two languages. So your left hemisphere is put to the test, and it's developing. It's your stronger muscle. And so for one reason or another, some of the attentional processes go towards your stronger muscle. Whether or not that results in better attention capabilities and what that has in terms of the implication, the bilingual kids better at verbal attention tasks, that is a whole other area to be explored, and we haven't gone into that direction. So stay tuned. These are developmental findings. This has already been found in adult bilinguals. So we're showing you the kid bilingual. So these are likely lifelong effects for a bilingual individual. It starts early in development and goes on into adulthood. So bilingual infants are not, I keep going over this, but bilingual infants are not confused. If you're caught at a playground with the parents, no, they're not confused. They're not delayed. The two languages do interact. We'll talk about this. They do interact. And that interaction potentially increases the demand for linguistic attention and attentional demands, making the brain, the left hemisphere, a stronger muscle for working on attentional type components of what our mental works do. And so that goes to the idea, is it okay to mix languages for the bilinguals? And the answer is in all likelihood, yes, absolutely, go ahead. If you're one of these households who just cannot stick to one language, one parent, I don't know if you've heard of these policies, it's okay. It's fine. And it will likely help them along. So what research has shown is that bilingual kids who are used to mixed language input will actually do better at learning new words when they're thrown at them outside of the specific language context. So it's not a detriment. Mixed language input is certainly not a detriment. And the mixing of the languages we find in young kids is also not a detriment. So can the brain acquire two languages? Most certainly, yes. In fact, that seems to promote the brain specialization for language. And moreover, it also plays a role in how other types of cognitive processes become organized in a bilingual child. So is the brain built for two languages? Yes. You strengthen the left hemisphere. Does not increase incidence of... So bilingualism by itself does not increase incidence of language impairments. We'll look through the language impaired data. minority learners. So this is different. This is where there's a lot of debates. So on one hand, systematic research from speech language pathology fields shows that no, bilingualism by itself does not increase the incidence of language impairments. But if you go to a school and download the data from the school districts, what you will discover is that minority learners are more likely to be classified as language impaired. Some of this, not all minority learners are bilingual because the schools won't split those data for you. They'll just tell you, well, these are Latino and, say, African-American populations, and they're more in need of learning services than the majority white kids. So that's not just the language issue at play. These are other issues. Remember, a lot of the immigrant kids come from low-SES environments. Their parents are struggling through. The kids will be struggling through just the same. If any of you have been to the trailer parks where migrant Latin American communities live, there's no books in those houses. I mean, you talk to kids, is there at least a Bible? I'm like, well, we're not sure, right? So these are homes where the parents oftentimes have only finished grade school. There's no literacy in the home. So there's a lot that goes on in these bilingual kids' lives, but the bilingualism by itself does not delay their development. There's a lot happening, and some of them do need the support, but it's not because they speak multiple languages.
A lot of your research has been done with the dramatic languages. What about some of the Asian languages where the intonation patterns and those type of things, and the grammar, the syntax is very different? And number two, at what age is a child learning a language as a second language? In other words, if we get a six-month-old, a one-year-old, who has been speaking primarily one language, and then they come to us for a preschool or a daycare setting, whatever, at what age are they learning a language as a second language versus they're being
bilingual,
bombarded
bilingually? That's a very good question. So with regard to languages, yes. So we have looked at Indo-European languages. French is not Germanic and Spanish. They're Romance. So these are Indo-European languages. There's nothing more dramatic of a difference than a sign language and a spoken language. So yes. Can you picture complete? So this is visual phonology. And visual language grammar, visual spatial processes. The markers are spatial. The pronouns are completely different in range. That's even further of a distance than Chinese. And they do fine. These kids are bilingual learners who reach the milestones of the two grammars at the same time. So yes, we do look at Chinese-English bilinguals, and that is true of them. But sort of the more out there dramatic demonstration is how our sign speech kids develop. I could not learn a sign language. I was in my graduate school, and I was like, I'm done. I can't process. This is where I was just, it was not coming in. This is when I stopped learning foreign languages. I was like, I was in a sign language. I was like, I'm done. My brain could not handle another language. They're very hard if you're learning them as an adult. And that brings us to the next issue. When are you learning another language? So by and large, in the bilingual field, if you're learning two languages before about the age of 7, we think you're a native learner of two languages. Before the age of 7 or so, you're considered to be a learner of two languages, and I'll explain. Because language acquisition is not complete almost until the age of 10. So what happens a lot to the immigrant children is they'll come to school. They might be born in this country, but they were home with grandma, and they go to school at age of 5 in Spanish. So they were speaking Spanish, and then they go to school in Ann Arbor where everybody speaks English. It's not Texas. And what will happen is that they'll go through a period where English has this rapid rise, and Spanish has what we call aborted development. So they are bilingual. This child is bilingual. You sort of have to add those two languages to get a full spectrum of competence. At some point, they will switch. So they're still Spanish dominant, but Spanish is not developing as much, right? It's a tricky, tricky slice. So many kids will go through that sort of red zone of 2-3 years. And they are. Both languages are native for them. If they were babies, it would have been the same deal, right? So you're coming to a point where you're not at from a zero, but you have an incomplete acquisition of Spanish that's happening right now. And the English is really new, and you have to really focus all your effort on learning that. And so they'll go through that 1 or 2 years of red zone, and then they'll come out as English speakers, right? And the parents will be very upset that the child no longer wants to speak Spanish in the house, but that's sort of what you have to consider. I've shown you a lot of sort of happy situations where the kids are actually proficient speakers of the two languages, but to give full due to what happens in a lot of the households, and that's what can happen, especially here in Texas, a little bit better.
The question is, you're talking about speech. How about written and reading? Would you still consider the child bilingual, or if he can only speak it but not write it?
That is absolutely correct. So I will show you these slides if we get to that section. So what will happen is that the child's home language, Chinese, Spanish, will influence how they read in English. Can get rid of it. But the child is bilingual, so you don't have to read. Let me put it this way. Sign language speakers, are they speakers or not of their language, even though there's no orthographic form to any sign language? So reading in a language, so orthography is a form of language. It's not an alien species, right? It's just, so instead of hearing the language, you see the language. The way you would see a sign language, you can see print. So if you know it, that's great. Remember, before Industrial Revolution, 90% of the population couldn't read, and that can take away from them, you know, the Homer's Odyssey that the history carried all the way to us initially through the Greek oral tradition.
Thank you. And I want to ask some questions. For example, my daughter, she started to be sent to the English-speaking daycare at the age of 3.
Mm-hmm.
So it is also the age that the personality and the social skills develop.
Of course.
So she, because she is relatively shy and cautious, so I'm not sure if the development of the second language will prevent her social skills or the personalities. That's what we can send, since now she seems a little bit lonely, since she is not confident about her second language. So I want to know.
Of course.
Suggestions or some.
Of course. We have the language brain, then we have the social brain. So, of course, the two of them will intersect. The language by itself does not usually influence children's social development. So if your child is shy and is not confident, so there's two types of, I try not to call them second language learners. We usually call them first language learners, but one is firster than the other. So in that, sorry about that, mucking with your English language. So in those situations, there's usually two kinds of kids. One of them is what you're describing, which is your daughter. They'll literally wait till they can speak. And they go through as long as half year periods of really not saying anything. It doesn't mean the language is not developing. Remember about babies who seem to know nothing because they don't speak? That's not true. Because to say a word, you have to have parsed the phonetic stream, figured out the sounds, figured out the syllables, and figured out the word-to-sound mapping. So there's a lot of going on. If we did a comprehension test, would show that she can understand and her grammar is setting in and everything's on track. She's just not talking, and that's her personality, as you said. And then there's some kids who just explode right away, and they don't know what they're saying. They'll just put words together, you know, the English sort of how do you do that's not parsed. So they'll have these expressions, they don't know what they mean, and they'll just be throwing them out. It's adorable. So that's fine. The daughter is not one of those, and that's absolutely normal.
Yeah, I was wondering if there was a distinctive patterns or structures of localization of various grammars in the speech area. Say, you have a child who's bilingual in English and Chinese, would the two grammars be in distinctly different places in the speech area?
We don't think so. So there's been a lot of excitement, a lot of initial bilingual brain imaging work was literally like, are they different two, like two spots in the brain? And the reason we thought for a long time there's two spots in the brain is that they're clinical patients who walk along, you know, brick falls on your brain, you wake up, your head, you wake up, and then you only can speak Latin. What does that mean? In fact, here in Ann Arbor, I was visiting a seamstress. They speak Russian. Their grandmother had a stroke, woke up, and can only speak German now. None of them do. So what do you do about that? And so there was, for a long time, and in neurology, we thought there's this thing that the two languages are organized in different places. You can knock one of them out and keep the other. There's no evidence to support that. So the idea that we have now is that it's actually localized in the same tissue, but you have different circuits. And so once one circuit is on, the other one is off. So it's in the same machinery, it's just different circuits. And so what you would see is that different grammars will result in different patterns of activity, but not in different locations. Okay. We can't seem to find the different spot. Okay. It seems to be literally in the same spot, just differently organized within it.
Could you just talk again about mixing languages and something about the one parent, one language? I didn't quite get what you meant by
so there's a, there's a common and old standing notion that to promote ideal bilingual child development, each parent should stick to a different language and not mix them, and that will somehow help kids go along with the language development. There's no support. It's neither hot nor cold. You can do it and your kid will be fine, or you cannot do it and your kid will be fine. So because there was this whole worry that, you know, the mixing will confuse the child between the two languages, well, it turns out the kids are smarter than we are. So it's okay. Whatever comes naturally, because when you force it, then it becomes a problem. So things become a problem when pediatrician tells a parent, oh, your child has a language delay, you should now speak English to your child, and English is not the parent's native language, the child begins to get broken input. The worst thing you can do to a child, especially an at-risk child, is give them broken input. That's just going to really help messing them up. There's only so much the brain can fix. But short of that, there's very little things you can do to do damage.
Hello. My question is more on multilingual children. Mm-hmm. So my granddaughter is in Switzerland. Mm-hmm. They speak Swiss German. She's hearing some French. Also, mother wants to, because she grew up here, she wants to speak, teach her English. And since we are Indian, there is another native language. So at least four languages she'll be hearing. So is there any research on multilingual?
There is research on multilingualism, and it always is very embarrassing to present any type of bilingual talk in front of people or colleagues from India. They laugh you out of the room, because bilingualism is the starting point and quadrilingualism and beyond is what you would actually be interested in studying for them, right? So for people who come from India, research on monolingual versus bilingual language or monolingual versus bilingual literacy is not even a question to explore. So yes, the populations that I was showing you at the beginning, I was showing you the speech sign bilinguals. So these were, this is my foray into bilingualism research. So the parents were, the mother was an American, she was deaf, she was an American, she spoke American Sign Language. And she went to the Gallaudet University, where she met another deaf individual who was from Montreal, Quebec, and he spoke Landesine Quebecois, the Quebec Sign Language. They moved to Montreal, a lovely bilingual city, and sent their kids to French-English immersion. So the kids were quadrilingual with two sign language and two spoken languages. And so they were picking up the milestones of the four languages at the same time. The problems usually is not on the child machinery. The problems are on the social machinery. As the family grew and became more acclimatized to their neighborhood, they end up moving into an LSK. Into the Francophone part of Montreal. So most of the neighbors are speaking LSQ or French. And so as more kids came along, those kids were bilingual. They were French and LSQ because the English had sort of dropped out of their environment. So the problem's rarely on the child in these situations. It's can you really keep up with all four outside of India or outside of those multilingual sort of European environments you're describing?
Thank you.
You're welcome. That's a good question. Yes, when we give talks about literacy and is it safe to teach children with with language impairments two languages at the same time, a colleague from India will inevitably ask, okay, we've got all the kids are bilingual and they come in, they speak Tamil and Hindi, and now we have to teach them English and some of them are language impaired. What do we do, right? So these are the usual questions that I get from these multilingual communities. All right. So how does brain support reading acquisition? We know that exposure to reading will change the way you process language. It will change the way you see things. It will change, and the changes will be different depending on the language. So some of you had asked Chinese versus English. So these in orthography, those would actually look quite different. And so the question is, well, what happens if you're bilingual and you're learning to read in multiple languages at the same time? So if you live in Ann Arbor and your language is English and you go to school, you will know to speak the word cat. And as you do, you probably know that it's associated with something that says meow. You'll eventually learn to print it onto C-A-T. Hence begins the problem because C is not always K, so try to figure that out. And so we're making these connections between the sound patterns in print and the meaning patterns with print. These patterns will differ across languages because in Spanish, what you will say is what you'll read and what will print. This is actually quite similar to Russian, too. But if you're going to read in Chinese, well, then good luck because what you're going to do, so Chinese is made out of words like, apple tree, right? So it's sort of it's a singular word that's made out of two words, and that's 99% of the Chinese vocabulary. It's made out of these two words we'll call compounds, and each of these words will actually have a character associated with it. So you're not mapping a sound to print. You're mapping a sort of semi-word unit to a grapheme, and so it's a different process, and it loads heavily on sort of those meaning-to-print associations. You're mapping the apple and you're mapping the tree. You're not mapping the apple tree the way you would do alphabetically. So we know this, and the question is, what happens to the kids who are learning to read in these languages? So we know that if we're going to look at the speakers of Italian versus the speakers of English, then we're going to see more activation, the parts of the brain that process phonology. Spanish, similar to Italian, sound to print mapping, very simple and intuitive in that regard. And Italian is easier than English, and it's more phonological, sound-based, so sound to letters. And so the Italian speakers tend to show more activation, the part of the brain that processes sound. If you're going to catch a Chinese speaker, it's going to be the reverse. Now the English speakers are showing more activation in the same part of the brain than the Chinese speakers. So that's for monolinguals. So what happens if you have two? So we know that if you're an adult second language learner, you're living in Ann Arbor and decide to take a Chinese language class when you were 12, well, then you're in trouble because it's going to be your Chinese reading will look like you're reading in English and the other way around. So we know, we call these transfer effects because you're taking what you know and you're using that to read in a new language because that's how your brain is built now. What happens if you're learning simultaneously in the two systems? How your brain's going to manage that? So I will show you some of our Spanish data. So when we think about bilingual acquisition, you can think about independence that we talked about, that they reach linguistic milestones at the same time. That suggests that they're sort of separate languages. And it's really neat if you are able to uncover two systems through literally one child. But there's also transfer. There is mixing, and we talked about them not being confused, but it doesn't mean that one language literally does not rub off onto the other. And so we wonder, what does that sort of rub off looks like? So we looked at the Spanish-English kids, looking right here in Ann Arbor. We had 35 kids. They're early exposed. They're young, and they're early exposed. They're English dominant. Again, I keep emphasizing Ann Arbor, Michigan. We really are not, you know, this is not downtown Texas. So we give them the usual language measures, and we're looking to see if speaking Spanish is influencing their reading acquisition. So this is what, and before I show you the data, there's no difference. These kids are attending our Ann Arbor school somewhere, you know, Bach, Burns Park, somewhere around these areas. on more extended ipsilanti. There's no difference between our bilingual and monolingual kids and how they read and their vocabulary, phonology, whatever you want to measure. So there's no difference here. But do they read differently? So looking at that phonological route, remember the sound-to-print mapping? So this is what a monolingual English speaker looks. Vocabulary is very, very important. Why is vocabulary very important? Well, because not to call English Chinese, but pretty close, my friends. Once you've passed learning how to spell the word cat, everything else is a lot of sort of memorization, which means you're mapping the word onto the way it's printed. Well, here's Spanish. Well, when these kids read in Spanish. So phonology is a big deal, and also is syntax. Why is syntax a big deal? Well, we owe to Spanish or to Latin the existence of the phonetic alphabets, right? So when the phonetic alphabets came to life in the form of Latin alphabet, if you do not convey a phonetic small change, go goes, it's a single sound change, you have to be able to put it on the alphabet. Or come came, right? It's now or it was in the past. It's a big change in the meaning. You have to be able to spell it out. So it's a big deal. So you need to know grammar, which is much more varied in Spanish than it is in English in that regard. And so these make a difference for kids when they read in Spanish. Here's how these kids look when they read in English. Remember, they read in English. Their accuracy is identical to the kids who are English monolinguals. And so similar to English monolinguals, they're relying on vocabulary, but they're also placing greater reliance on the English phonology and the English syntax, which is very similar to how they read in Spanish. So even though there's no difference in the accuracy, they're not doing any worse than a monolingual child. The way they look at their spoken language to figure out a printed word is actually similar to the way you would do it in Spanish. So the spoken language makes that impact. And so quickly to show you the brain, so we show the reading differences and then to look at the brain. We had a group of Spanish-English bilinguals and French-English bilinguals. French is not as transparent phonologically sound-to-letter mapping as is Spanish, but it's not as awful as English. No offense to all of the people here who speak English as their native language. Russian used to be equally as horrible, and then we had the communist revolution. Not that you should have a communist revolution, but oh boy, that, you know, your writing system needs some help. Okay, so we've got, it doesn't need to be that way. What they did because Russian alphabet came from the 1200s and it was sort of like Shakespearean English. There were vowels and consonants that no longer existed in the language, but the letters were still there. And so it was purged systematically to make the orthography map the early 1920s phonology of the language and its grammar. So it was brought on par to the modern day. Well, you had to have the people read the communist propaganda. How were you going to do that if they were illiterate? So, small potatoes. So back to reality, and our little kids, they're reading the regular words, such as carpet, regularly spelled words, and the regularly spelled words, such as island, how many islands I've heard in my life, and the pseudo words, something like blicket. And so we are going to, remember I showed you some Italian and English data. So this is what happens when you read those pseudo words like blicket. Because there's no right or wrong way of reading a pseudo word. It doesn't exist. Pseudo words don't exist. I just made them up. You can do whatever you like with it. And so when the English speakers read pseudo words, either Broca turns on. Broca's areas for the hard phonological stuff and the visual areas. And then for the Spanish, for Italian speakers, it's the Wernicke's area. It's the phonological part of the brain. So we've got these really nice clear differences in terms of cross-linguistic differences, frontal lobe, the hard stuff, Italian in the back for the easy stuff. What's going to happen? What's going to happen if you're bilingual? Here's what happens. So these are the tasks. So regular words, no differences. Irregular words, just like you would expect, a lot of islands in the Spanish and French kids are like, what is that? But there's no difference in the blickets and the pseudo words between the two groups. Remember, English monolinguals, frontal lobe, the hard phonology, Italians, back of the brain, the easy phonology. It turns out the monolingual English, these are English, they're not reading in Italian or in Spanish, right? They're reading in English. And so when they read in English, the monolingual kids actually show more of that Broca's area activation, which we see at the front in English. and then right check mark. And when you do the opposite subtraction, we take the bilinguals and subtract out the monolinguals, well, that's when you get the back of the brain. They're reading in English. Remember, there's no difference in their reading on that task. And this is the French bilinguals looking very similarly to that. So the way you read is different. The way your brain processes print is different depending on your language experiences. And we get the exact, so it affects your literacy, affects your brain. We do get contrasting effects for Chinese, so it literally shifts the other way around. And again, at no cost to the child, as far as we can tell from the accuracy in which they read. They just read differently. And then when you think about this, you can send your kid to a classroom right here in Ann Arbor, and some teachers really like the phonics approach, and they will really stay on the phonics approach in the same school, in the same environment. Fred Morrison, who I think spoke right before me here, studies this, this sort of, even when the school makes a decision, the teachers themselves will still vary. And one of the teachers, same sort of grade two, will really favor more of the traditional whole word approach. English is irregular. I'm sorry, there's lots of islands. There's only so much you can learn from phonological coding. And will prefer to sort of more of a whole word approach. And then they can switch the next year after. What does this cost the developing child? Well, they will read, they might read somewhat differently, but it's not life or death situation. It doesn't really damage the child and their reading system when these variations are at this scale. So speaking a language that that weighs differently on the phonetic versus the lexical system for reading does not make them bilinguals, an impaired reader of English. They just shift them a little bit along the continuum of how you would use these networks early in development. That is not to advocate either for phonics or whole word, right? Everybody's agreed we need a balanced approach. But in that world of balanced approach, shifting right or left in this sort of subtle ways will have an impact, but it will not impair the child. They're certainly not dyslexic. So all had high, this is what I was trying to tell you, my friends, all had really high monolingual reading proficiency, so this is all good news. Why do we think this happens? That's because reading and language are the same to a large extent. The spoken language structure, remember, precedes. We were speakers of a language before we were readers of a language, not just developmentally, but historically. So the languages, the orthographies, the way are invented, the mapping onto that. So what happens to a child when they speak the two languages is that the two languages intersect with each other. They're not confused, but the language is different. The language of the English of a Spanish English child is different from that of an English monolingual child, and is different from that of a Chinese English child. So the language is different. And so when they learn how to read, they approach the word with these biases that that come from the spoken language systems. So as a monolingual and speaker of only one language, you're sort of constrained to the way you see language and literacy. Bilinguals are enriched. And by their cross-linguistic experience, and so may experience language differently. In practice, this is shows you the flexibility of the underlying machinery. When we have these debates, such as phonics or whole-word approaches, well, one has to take into account the amazing amount of flexibility in the systems and multiple paths to successful reading acquisition. So it has implications for literacy instruction for both bilingual and monolingual kids. And on the last note, this is an exciting new project we had started in San Francisco where they actually have bilingual immersion schools. So these are kids going into the schools, Spanish from kindergarten versus Chinese from kindergarten. So we're excited to see how these kids turn out and compare to each other. Because here I look at the kids who come from heritage language schools such as El Nuestra Lingua and the Chinese heritage language schools, whereas this is a formal dual language approach we're trying out. All right, my friends, last time. The bilingualism does not delay language or reading acquisition. Age of acquisition matters. If your child doesn't start English till age 3, you may need to wait a little bit till they catch on, and that makes a difference. Quality of exposure, of course, matters. And language mixing, bilingual kids are not confused. Similar to adult, bilingual adults, there is cross-linguistic transfer. And language alternation might actually be beneficial to some of the attentional developmental attentional processes in the young bilingual kids. So language is complicated, right? The timing of learning, you have the influence of your culture. Learning to read needs to be explicitly taught as opposed to just spoken language. And then the brain changes. And then it becomes even more complicated when you're learning two languages. Now you have the timing of the two and two types of environmental influences. And now you need explicit instruction in multiple orthographic systems. And then your brain changes, as we just discussed a moment ago. So this is what I do. This is my job. This is why I have a job here, is I try to parse out through these complexities to ultimately understand the human brain. We're the only species walking this planet endowed with the ability to use language. Spoken language, sign language, written language, we're the only ones who can do it. And so part of what we do in trying to understand language is to understand this plasticity and the flexibility of the endowed biological system that allows us to learn language and how it's not limited in learning one. It can accommodate for multiple systems and how it varies across languages. So on that note, I thank everybody who made my work possible, and thank you so much for coming. And if there's more questions, I'm happy to answer.